Very good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is number 054355, David Lee against John Keith et al. Mr. Yadik?
Good morning, and may it please the court. Richard Madich, counsel for appellant, David Lee. Your Honors, this case is about choice, a candidate's choice to stand for election independently of any political party, and the voter's choice to associate with such candidates. This court should reverse the district court decision upholding Illinois Election Code Section 10.3 for three reasons. First, the filing deadline and signature requirement in Section 10.3, when viewed in with respect to Illinois' entire ballot access scheme, severely burdened the development of independent candidacies. Second, as the Supreme Court squarely held in Storr versus Brown, running as a new party candidate is not an adequate alternative for independent candidates that mitigates the burdens of Illinois' laws. Finally, on balance, the filing deadline and signature requirement are neither sufficiently beneficial nor narrowly tailored enough to justify the severe burdens they impose on truly independent candidates. With respect to my first point, in Anderson v. Celebrezze, the United States Supreme Court set forth a three-part test for determining challenges to state ballot access laws. Under the first prong, this court must weigh the burdens imposed on plaintiffs' asserted rights. Second, the court must evaluate the precise interests put forth by the state. Lastly, the court must decide whether, on balance, the state's asserted interests make it necessary to burden independents' rights. Where a state's laws impose a severe burden on the rights of independent candidates, the state bears the burden of demonstrating that those laws are narrowly tailored and serve compelling state interests. In Storr v. Brown, the United States Supreme Court said that history would be the guide as to whether or not a state's laws do in fact severely burden independent candidates. In fact, quoting the court, past experience will be a helpful, if not always unerring, guide. It will be one thing if independent candidates have qualified with some regularity, and quite a different matter if they have not. Here, the district court was presented with undisputed historical evidence that not one independent candidate has been able to satisfy Section 10.3 in the last 25 years.
Is there any evidence in the record about how many may have tried? I suppose that's a hard thing to prove, but is there anything in the record about that?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, there is nothing in the record as to that. However, what we do know is that is a precipitous decline in the amount of independent candidacies since between 1975 and 1979 when Illinois amended its laws. Prior to 1975, Illinois required independents to obtain signatures equaling only 5% of the last vote, and those signatures were due only between 78 and 90 days before the general election. Under those laws, 14 independent candidates qualified for state legislative office between 1956 and 1974. I'd also note that in 1974, there were seven independent candidacies alone. So just to give you some idea.
All of those qualified?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Whatever the requirements, or were there requirements?
I'm sorry, I don't
understand. Were there requirements that were, obviously they were less difficult at that time?
That's
what
correct.
What did it take to get on the ballot then?
In 1974, it took obtaining signatures equal to 5% of the last vote, and those signatures were due between 78 and 90 days before the general election. So the signature requirement was roughly half as burdensome as it is today, and the filing deadline was three times later than it is today.
No, that was before the general election or the primary?
That was before the general election, Your
and
Honor.
And, of course, they weren't in a primary.
That's
so
correct.
So you could get an independent candidate qualified after the regular parties had chosen their candidates?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Isn't that really the most significant difference between the old order and the new?
Your Honor, I would agree with that. I do think that's a significant difference. And that, in fact, in Anderson versus Celebrezze, the United States Supreme Court recognized that early filing deadlines for independent candidates are particularly burdensome for just that reason, that they deny the voters the opportunity, once the established parties have positioned themselves, to choose something outside the mainstream.
That, in your view, is what the Illinois statute attempts to prevent.
That's correct, Your Honor. I would also note that in Storr versus Brown, the Supreme Court remanded a challenge to California's laws based on evidence that only one independent candidate had ever been able to satisfy those requirements. And in Mandel versus Bradley, in remanding that case, the court noted that no independent candidate had been able to qualify under, I believe it was Maryland's laws, over two election cycles, and they found that to be significant. Again, here we've gone 25 years without an independent candidate.
Does the record contain any information as to the relative lengths of times observed in other states for independent candidates? Where does Illinois fit into the national picture here?
Your Honor, Illinois is, by far and away, has the earliest filing deadline of all the states. In fact, if I could draw Your Honor's attention to pages 21 and 22 of the supplemental appendix, we actually have two charts that demonstrate the petition deadlines for independents throughout the nation. And as you can see, Illinois has the earliest. The next earliest would be Ohio. Ohio has independent candidates file in March of the year of the general election. However, that's one day before the primary, and established party candidates have to file 60 days before the primary. So independents have some notion of which candidates are going to run on a party platform in that state. And I'd also note that in Ohio, that law is joined by only a 1% signature requirement, where here in Illinois, it's a 10% requirement.
The Ohio independent candidates have the same disability as the Illinois candidates, do they not, in that they do not know the identity of the party choices?
Well, Your Honor, I would actually submit that they have a far better idea than candidates in Illinois, and that's because party candidates have to file their papers 60 days before the primary, and independents are permitted to file their papers on the day of the primary, they have an idea of who has filed their papers, and they would also by that point have some idea of who will probably come out of the primary as the nominee.
Well, they may or may not, depending on good their fingers is in, you know, catching the, you know, the drift of the wind. But basically, they still, if they did run in the primary, they might indeed be victorious. They might be the representative of the dominant faction of the party, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Of course, the coincidence of the independent registering on primary day is the same time all other final candidates would be identified.
With respect to Illinois, that's correct. All candidates.
Well, I think there's Ohio that you can register the last day or something.
In Ohio, independent candidates file their papers the day of the primary.
Because that's the day everybody's going to be identified on the fall ballot.
That's correct.
And independent, of course, doesn't have to have a primary, so that's why that is. And as you point out, those are differences. And when you look at all of the state laws, it just seems there are so many variables that states come up with. And I'm not going to question the fact that many of them are to try to keep a competition out. They don't want independence. They don't want somebody disrupting it. We have now a situation with MoveOn.org, who nobody controls, and yet they put all kinds of money into campaigns. There are a lot of election problems, but what do you expect us to do, to rewrite the law?
No, Your Honors. That would obviously, that's in the hands of the legislature. However, this court does have the power to uphold the Constitution and to permit independent candidates simply a reasonable opportunity to appear on the ballot.
Are you asking us to adopt a rule that the independent candidates should not have to file until the time of the primary?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that that's necessary. And that's because the states have variously set their primaries at different points during the year.
But unless we do that, isn't the underlying infirmity of the Illinois scheme going to still be in place? Is there anything other than a rule that allows an independent candidate to file after the primary that would satisfy your argument?
Well, Your Honor, I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that the governing time period is from the amount of time out from the general election. And it's true that one facet of independent candidates is that it's good for them to know who the established party candidates are. But I would say more important than that is that independent candidacies typically arise in response to the issues that are discussed during an election campaign. When you're talking about a filing deadline in December before the general election, that's simply too far out to have an idea of which issues the campaign is going to crystallize around. So it is possible that you could have a filing deadline that occurs prior to the primary, so long as the primary is not too far out from the general election, such that the issues in the election are not crystallized by that point.
What about federal elections? Do these laws impact federal elections?
In Illinois, they do, Your Honor. That's correct.
Is it the same?
Yes. Independent candidates have to file filed 323 days before the general, and they still need 10% to qualify for state office or federal office as well.
So an independent wanting to run for Congress, do they have to do the petitions and all that stuff?
They do, Your Honor. That's correct.
And that varies from state to state, then?
That does vary.
Federal elections.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Does the record indicate what the average time is, filing time is among the states?
Well, Your Honor, the record, we've cited several cases, and I would say it's fair to say that the circuit courts, on a whole, have said about 200 days out from the general election is about as far as they go. Ohio does fall a little bit beyond that. That's about 270 days, but again, that's joined with only a 1% signature requirement. And indeed, in Lawrence versus Blackwell, the Sixth Circuit discussed that fact, and it suggested that the only reason that that filing deadline was permissible was because it was joined with only a 1% signature requirement.
I take it your argument is that we should consider these two requirements, the signature requirement and the date requirement, together in terms of the burden they place. Am I correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that's particularly important here because filing deadlines for independent candidates that are so far out from the general election make it very difficult for independents to obtain the requisite number of signatures. At that far out from the general election, getting the voters' attention is difficult. Attracting and recruiting volunteers to help gather signatures is difficult. And I would also note that it falls between September and December. The weather actually could be an issue at that point as well. So there are several burdens.
Refresh my recollection. If a voter does sign the petition, what is the restriction on the voter's participation in further electoral matters?
If a voter signs an independent candidate's petition, they are barred from voting in any party primary for that period. Certainly they could vote in a party primary at a next election cycle, but for that election cycle, they are barred.
And who's going to check on that?
But presumably it would be the Illinois State Board of Elections that would be responsible.
So that would have to go out too then, wouldn't it? Especially if you shortened the time period. There wouldn't be any time to check on those names. There wouldn't there, unless they had some electronic thing that when you go in to vote in a primary, they said, well, you've already signed a petition for the independent. You can't vote. Is that what would happen?
Presumably, Your Honor. Unfortunately, there's nothing in the record that suggests one way or the other how the board accomplishes that.
Well, the thing I'm concerned about is that for any election, you're asking us to declare something unconstitutional, and I guess implicitly to say something that is constitutional. And that would apply to lots more than just the state, especially if it also affects federal elections. And we then would be asking us to set up a standard that fits constant. I don't see how we do that without rewriting the law completely. And what time period is it? Is what's too much and not enough? And should it be the same day or should it be 30 days? I mean, do we have to determine that?
Your Honor, no. In fact, I would point out that Lindell versus Juergen, in a case we cited in our brief, that's a district court decision. However, that case amply demonstrates how a state set a signature requirement at 15%. It was challenged. It was struck down. It then went back and it set it at 10%. It was challenged again. It was struck down. There were issues with the filing deadline in that case as well. The legislature has the flexibility to set its standards as it sees fit. And it's this court that would have to then look at the case law and determine whether the state has gone too far in restricting the development of independent candidacies.
How does it affect other election laws, let's say just in this circuit? If we were to say some period of time is wrong, Indiana is different.
That's correct.
For instance, then there are a lot of people who run in primaries for president, for example. Let's say there are five people running. In Indiana, you can sign all five petitions.
Right.
Apparently in Illinois, you cannot.
That's correct, Your Honor. Illinois restricts the voters in that fashion. I would like to actually go back and correct something that I said before in response to your question. You asked whether or not this applies to all elections, federal, state, and what have you. I would just point out that the signature requirement is actually less for certain statewide offices than it is for state district offices. Those signature requirements found in Section 10.3 are actually 5% for statewide offices. So it is a little bit less. Same filing deadline, though. So the fact still remains they have to file almost a year out from the general election.
Smaller percentage, but bigger pool of voters, obviously.
That's correct, Your Honor. Same restrictions on the pool of voters, however. So moving to my second point, the state seeks to justify its filing deadline and signature requirement for independent candidates by reference to its requirements for new party candidates. But, Your Honors, the Supreme Court confronted that issue and rejected it in Storer versus Brown. There, the court noted that independent candidacies and new party candidacies serve two separate and distinct forms of political activity, but that neither is an adequate substitute for the other. Illinois seeks to avoid that result here by arguing that under its laws, the two types of candidacies are functionally equivalent. However, the Storer court was clear. This is an issue of principle, not pragmatism, and a state cannot constitutionally condition ballot access for independent candidates upon their forming a new political party. Moreover, there are real significant practical differences in the way Illinois treats new parties on the one hand and independents on the other. For example, signers of new party petitions must expressly declare their intent to form a new political party. And indeed, at the record, on Supplemental Appendix page 44, you have an example of the petition circulated by James T. Meeks, and you can see how the voters are expressly declaring that intent.
Mr. Madich, I believe your time has expired.
Oh, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We'll hear now from Mr. Finnegan.
May it please the court, counsel, I'm Gary Feinerman from the Office of the Illinois Attorney General on behalf of the defendants, appellees, members of the State Board of Elections. Because the Constitution gives the state substantial power to regulate elections, in particular state elections, this court should affirm the district court's judgment, which upheld the constitutionality of the ballot access provisions for independent candidates from the General Assembly. With respect to the filing deadline, under Section 10.3, which is the same as the filing deadline for candidates in party primaries for the General Assembly, this court has already upheld that deadline in Stevenson versus State Board of Elections. Now, in the briefs, there was some discussion over whether Stevenson upheld the deadline with respect to the particular circumstances present in the Stevenson case or generally. And we acknowledge in our brief that the concurrence in Stevenson would have preferred to limit the reach of that case to the particular circumstances of that case. But if you look at the district court decision, which was adopted by the majority of this court, the district court's decision was really categorical. Its analysis on pages 550 to 555 analyzed and approved the December filing deadline without mentioning Mr. Stevenson's unique circumstances. In particular, the paragraph that straddles page 553 to 554 squarely addressed the validity of the simultaneous filing requirement, and by that I mean the filing requirement is the same for independent candidates and candidates who propose to run in the party primary election, and concluded that it advanced important state interests. Then in the second full paragraph of page 555, the district court concluded that the filing deadline strikes a fair and reasonable balance between the state's interests and the interest of prospective independent candidates. The district court went on to address the unique circumstances of the Stevenson case and concluded that although Stevenson might have had the best argument for finding in his circumstances that the deadline was unconstitutional, the court thought that the burden on him was not substantial enough. So in a sense, the majority of this court in Stevenson, by adopting the district court's analysis, took kind of the 180 opposite view of the case, viewed the case through the opposite lens of the concurrence. According to the concurrence, the deadline was plainly constitutional with respect to Mr. Stevenson, but perhaps not for what the concurrence called a true independent that decided to run in January. The district court viewed the deadline as constitutional as a general matter, and kind of conversely to the concurrence, said that Stevenson might have had the strongest constitutional claim, but the deadline was constitutional even as to him. And however you look at it, that decision was undoubtedly correct. What I hear...
If I could interrupt for a minute, the Supreme Court has instructed that historical practice under these ballot access rules is a significant factor in evaluating the constitutionality. And the Stevenson case was 20 years old. And in the space of that time, no one has qualified as an independent under these rules. Doesn't that mean something for purposes of our current analysis and whether Stevenson is still any good?
It's not meaningless, but it doesn't mean much. In 1980, as the plaintiff's expert pointed out, there were three candidates, independent candidates for the General Assembly, that succeeded in getting onto the general election ballot. The record, to answer one of the questions from the panel, the record does not indicate whether any prospective independent candidates tried but failed. There was some discovery exchange that's not in the record. But I can report that from 1998 on, no independents tried. The discovery did not indicate whether anybody prior to 1998, anybody tried to get on through the independent candidate ballot access provisions for the General Assembly. And it's unclear why that is. If I were to guess, I would say that it's because the new party provisions that allow new party candidates to get on the ballot for the General Assembly are just a lot easier to satisfy. The filing deadline is about 3 months prior to the general election, and the signature requirement is half. And if you're an independent-minded candidate who truly does not want to be affiliated with one of the two major parties, and you're deciding how you're going to get on the ballot, it's a pretty easy choice. You go the new party route rather than the independent candidate route. And as Judge Easterbrook explained in his concurrence in Stevenson, and as the district court explained in its decision in Stevenson, there really is very little practical difference for the candidate between the independent party route and the new party route.
That's not what the Supreme Court thinks.
The Supreme Court said in Storr that there was a difference in California between the independent party route and the new party route. But that's because in California, if you want to establish a new party, you have to set up an entire party apparatus. That's not the case in Illinois. And all Mr. Lee needed to do to run as a new party candidate was to set up a David Lee party. He didn't have to have a primary election or a convention or really any party apparatus.
And aren't there impediments on the eligible voters who can sign petitions under this new party route of getting on the ballot?
Actually not.
Voters who sign these petitions under the new party ballot access rules don't have to make some sort of a statement that they're willing to support this new party?
They do, but my understanding from the State Board of Elections is that just because somebody votes in the primary in March does not preclude that person from signing a new party candidate petition in May.
But they have to declare their intention to support the new party, not just this particular candidate. So there is a material legal difference between running as an independent and running as a new party candidate?
There may be a legal difference, but I would say that it's not material, particularly in circumstances where the new party is just kind of for all practical purposes, an individual running for the General Assembly. Mr. Lee didn't have to run as a slate. He could just run as himself, as the David Lee party. And as Judge Easterbrook explained in detail in his concurrence in Stevenson, that easy mechanism in Illinois to establish new parties really distinguishes the new party scheme in Illinois from the new party scheme in Storr. And unlike as in Storr, there really is no material difference here between an independent and a new party candidate for the limited purposes we're talking about here in this case.
What's the point of having two different sets of rules then?
It's a good question. And the plaintiff mentioned that in his reply brief, and here's our response. Illinois does provide a ready means for new political voices to emerge in the system. But it provides incentives for those new voices to be heard through new parties rather than independents. And that's permissible. It's permissible for Illinois to favor the party system over a system that is more facilitative of independence. In Timmins, the Supreme Court said that the Constitution allows states, quote, to decide that political stability is best served through a healthy two-party system. If that's true, then the state can certainly take the lesser step and more flexible approach of deciding that stability is best served through a party system. And how does that play into our case? It plays in this sense. The David Lee Party may end up being very successful, assuming that he had founded that, and attracting a great deal of support from voters. And if he were to get 5% of the vote, he would actually be, the David Lee Party would be an established political party. And that would provide a way of channeling political disputes into a party system. If like-minded voters and candidates coalesce around a new party, there will be less factionalism and more stability than if the new voices were heard through independent candidacies. And that's it's a choice as to what's better and what's not. That's really a matter of political science that I can't opine on.
If I could interrupt for a minute, how would the general election operate then if Mr. Lee, for example, had formed the David Lee Party and gotten on the ballot in that way, and a voter in this district wanted to vote for him for the state legislature? Would that voter be disabled from voting for other candidates in statewide office, for example, in one or the other of the parties, or can you mix your ballots?
Oh, in the general election, you don't have to vote a straight ticket.
Okay.
You could vote for David Lee for state rep and John Kerry or George Bush for president.
So there are no impediments at the general election in the ballot box to splitting a ticket like that?
Oh, no, not at all. What Mr. Lee wants to do here, and he's admirably candid about it, is he wants to wait and see what positions the major parties will adopt and what candidates the major parties will nominate before he decides to run as an independent. And I can't blame him for wanting to do that. It's a natural thing to want to do. But my point here is that the Constitution does not require the state to allow him to do that as an independent candidate. In Storr, the Supreme Court said that the states have a legitimate interest in, quote, protecting the direct primary process by refusing to recognize independent candidates who do not make early plans to leave a party and take the alternative course to the ballot. And that's what the simultaneous filing deadline does here. It precludes a potential independent candidate from postponing a decision to run as an independent until he or she can assess his or her chances of winning in the primary. In a sense, it distinguishes true independence, and Mr. Lee talks about this concept of a true independent. A true independent doesn't care which way the wind is blowing in a primary election, either during the primary campaign or afterwards, to see who has won. A true independent is going to run as an independent regardless of what the parties do.
If the independent is someone who is fed up with his or her party or corruption, cronyism, all sorts of things that people just are fed up, they are truly in one party or the other and said, this is it, that person is just doesn't represent me or anyone else, and I want to run as an independent, but it's probably too late when all of that occurs. And I guess what you're saying is, well, then they have to change the law. Maybe they should change the law, but it's not unconstitutional when a person gets himself in that position.
That's exactly right, and the Supreme Court has approved precisely what I'm talking about, which is requiring independents to fish or cut bait before the primary process. In Storr v. Brown, the court approved a disaffiliation statute which required prospective independent candidates to disaffiliate from a party a year before the actual primary election. In Monroe, M-U-N-R-O, the Supreme Court approved a California law that required independents to run in a blanket primary as an independent. And obviously, for a candidate to do that, the candidate has to declare as an independent prior to the primary and, in fact, during the primary campaign season. The Burdick case from 1992 approved a similar Hawaii scheme, which required nonpartisan candidates to run in a nonpartisan primary election. If Mr. Lee were right that the Constitution gave him the ability and the absolute right to decide to become an independent candidate either during the primary season or after the primary season, then those three cases were incorrectly decided.
Well, I don't know, though, that, I mean, those cases addressed discrete ballot access rules. What we have here is a combination of ballot access rules that Mr. Lee is alleging operate together to violate his constitutional rights, and I don't think there's any case that has a combination of ballot access rules like that which we have here. I mean, this is the earliest filing deadline on record, so far as I can tell. I mean, the Supreme Court and no court of appeals has ever upheld a filing deadline this early, and it's the highest signature requirement as a percentage, coupled with the disabilities that are placed on those who sign the petitions. And so this sort of package of ballot access rules has never presented before. So I think those cases are of limited application, I guess is the point I'm driving at, and maybe you can disabuse me of that notion.
I'll try. The deadline was upheld in Stevenson. There's always the new, and part of the reason the deadline was upheld in Stevenson is because there is this new party outlet. The new party ballot access provisions provide an outlet for candidates, prospective candidates who are dissatisfied with the two major parties. And with respect to the signature requirement, it's 10% of the actual votes in the previous election, which on average and over time works out to about 5% of all registered voters, which was upheld in the Jenis case by the U.S. Supreme Court and the Prestia case by the Second Circuit. And sure, no state has precisely the same package of ballot access provisions, but that's just the nature of federalism. Each state does it differently, and there are benefits and there are burdens that each state has, and only if the entire package makes it impossible or really is really prohibitive does the Constitution speak.
Can I ask you what the historical impetus was for the change in the rules?
There's not much legislative history on this, and none of it's in the record. I looked at it. I think if you look at the legislative history, you'll see that these laws were passed in 75 and 79. You'll see Senator Netsch, as you might expect, was not in favor of these provisions. Senator Pate explained that there were situations in Chicago where the loser in the Democratic Party would peel off and run as an independent and either win or draw votes from the Republican candidate. And essentially the point he was making a point about the continuation of intra-party feuds after the primary, the things that the primary was supposed to take care of, and he was talking about party rating may be the wrong word, but a way of for parties to bleed off votes that might otherwise go to the other party by kind of covering the field in the general election by having the party candidate and by having a faux independent.
So these provisions were intended to operate essentially as the sore loser ballot access restrictions that exist in other states?
It does more than the sore losers don't get candidates who are about to lose in the primary and then pull out before they lose. It's really intended to make sure that if there is going to be an independent candidate, that the independent candidate A is truly independent and not merely a disaffected party member, and B has a significant modicum of support that justifies putting that person on the ballot.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Feinerman. Does Mr. Madick have any time left? Mr. Madick, counsel for the appellee answered questions a little bit over, so I'm going to give you 2 minutes if you have something to say.
Just make a couple quick points. First of all, Stevenson is easily distinguishable on the facts, and those facts are important. When you were dealing with in Stevenson is a disaffected party member, there the state's interest in preventing factionalism and the disruption of the primary process was up front and center. True independent candidates,
But did the court decide the case on that ground?
This court, in adopting the district court decision, expressly said that the factual setting of that case epitomized the type of intra-party factionalism and squabbling that the state can reasonably regulate in the interest of an orderly ballot access process. Here, that interest is simply not at issue. Secondly, the appellee noted Timmons and the Supreme Court's decision in Timmons. However, before the court noted that in practice laws could favor the two-party system, it said that states cannot enact laws that insulate the two-party system from independent candidacies and new party candidacies. And in saying that, the court cited to Anderson and Williams, two cases that support Mr. Lee's proposition. Finally, Your Honors, for the reasons set forth in our brief and the reasons discussed here today, we ask that you reverse the decision of the district court. Thank you very much.
Well, the court thanks both counsel for their very fine briefs and very fine oral argument today. The case will be taken under advisement.